Okay, folks, I think we might begin. We may have a few more people coming in. Thank you all for coming on a beautiful May Friday afternoon where you should be somewhere else enjoying the weather. But we do appreciate it. And by the way, let me just say, assure you that despite our title, The Power of Truth, this is not a sort of evangelical praise the Lord session. So you'd be quite safe. Each year, what we try to do, before I begin, let me thank in particular the US-Ukraine Foundation and the US-Moldova Foundation for helping to co-sponsor our event this afternoon. And our event this afternoon, in fact, is almost an annual event. We try to do this each year in order to acknowledge the important anniversary coming up on May 9th, which is the end of World War II in Europe. But our approach is a bit unconventional. We don't look so much at the history, but what we do is we get specialists to look at the uses of history and the uses of the symbols of history by the authorities in Russia and what purposes it serves in contemporary politics, especially in the context of Moscow's policies in its neighborhood and in Central Eastern Europe. And before I introduce our three and possibly four speakers, and I'll explain that in a moment, I wanted to say just a very few words about the significance of the recent Katyn affair. And Nina here is much more of an authority on covering the Katyn issue, so she'll say much more depth or develop in much more depth. I'm just going to say my own thoughts in a few words. The significance of the recent Katyn affair following the Kaczynski plane crash. And I would say that to some degree, at least for the past few weeks, the 1940 Katyn anniversary, in other words, the 70th anniversary of the murder of Polish officers, not just in Katyn, but in other places, has to some degree overshadowed the Victory Day anniversary. Indeed, I believe there is a tension, some sort of tension or even a conflict between the two. Very briefly, I think, let me put it this way, Moscow's Victory Day anniversary is intended to demonstrate that Russia, or as the inheritor of the Soviet Union, was the primary victim and the primary victor of World War II, whereas the Katyn massacre tends to demonstrate that Russia was also a principal planner and perpetrator of World War II. So that's what I mean by the sort of conflict or tension between the two anniversaries. Now, how can these two facts be reconciled? Was Stalin a mass murderer or liberator? How can the Soviet Union liberate Eastern Europe when it itself was not liberated? I remember Premier Tusk, I think it was the Westerplatte anniversary when Putin was there, said, well, thank you for coming to oust the Nazis, but you certainly didn't bring us liberation or freedom because you didn't have it yourselves. So there's that. You know, this interpretation that the neighbors have that the Russian authorities do not. But I'm not going to spend too much time on the Katyn. I have an article actually in an issue of Wider Europe, which is distributed and appeared in the Washington Times a few weeks ago, and I'm not going to cover the same territory. So let me just introduce our four speakers. My voice is beginning to go. I was in Athens last week, and I've got the health equivalent of the Greek contagion. I hope it doesn't affect my wallet as well, but anyway. Four speakers. Let me start with three. We may have a fourth, depending on technical capabilities. First of all, we have Saulius Sujedielis, who's Professor Emeritus of History at Millersville University of Pennsylvania. A little bit of background. Between 82 and 87, he was a research historian for the U.S. Department of Justice, and during 89-90 worked as a radio journalist and commentator for the Voice of America. He is the author of a number of scholarly books and articles on Lithuanian history and has been a member of the International Commission for the Evaluation of the Crimes of the Nazi and Soviet occupation regimes in Lithuania. Secondly, we have Nina Khrushcheva, who is a professor of media and culture at the graduate program of International Affairs, as well as a senior fellow of the World Policy Institute at the New School University, and an adjunct professor at the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University. In addition, she is a senior editor of Project Syndicate, Association of Newspapers around the world. Widely published lectures, very widely. In fact, we met during a lecture, I think it was at the State Department a few years ago. Third on my left is Vladimir Karamurza, Jr. Vladimir is a Washington bureau chief of RTVI television network, previously correspondent for Novaya Izvestia and Kommersant newspapers, and editor-in-chief of the Russian Investment Review. 2000 to 2003, he was an advisor to Boris Nemtsov, leader of the opposition in State Duma, and a candidate also for the Russian parliament in the 2003 elections. In 2007-08, he served as campaign chairman for presidential candidate Vladimir Bukovsky, who unfortunately we tried, but he couldn't be with us here today, maybe because of our smoking prohibitions, but anyway, that's... Vladimir is also a member of the Federal Council of the Democratic Movement Solidarity, and he's promised to get me a flag of the organization one of these days. Last but not least, if we are lucky, and I'm not sure the technical situation is at the moment, we're planning to have Edvin Snorre live by video link from Riga, Latvia. Let me introduce him in case he does appear, so I won't have to do this afterwards. Edvin is the author and director of a new film called The Soviet Story, and the film won the jury's Mass Impact Award at the 2008 Boston Film Festival and has been shown on national television and Europe and is now screening on public broadcasting stations, TV stations in the United States. It has been translated in 30 languages, was filmed over several years in places like, including Russia, Ukraine, Latvia, Germany, France, UK, and Belgium. It presents a truly unique insight into recent Soviet history, told by people who were formerly Soviet citizens, or who had first-hand knowledge of being on the, in the Soviet Union during those times. And I've seen the film. It's remarkable. There's one or two things that I never knew, including, I'm not going to tell you what happens, but an interview by Bernard Shaw and his support for gassing superfluous people. But anyway, that's watch the film if you have the chance, called The Soviet Story, and Edvin's will be able to tell you more about it. Anyway, let us begin on my left with Saulius.
Thank you, Mr. Bogaisky, for such a nice introduction. I think that in some sense I have to be a little bit of a wet blanket on this political discussion because I'm actually more interested in the historical aspects of this question of World War II and conflicting perspectives. But let's take it off the top here. If we look at September 1st, 1939, which for many people in the West, certainly for Poland, is the beginning of World War II, then we'll see that the infamous Dachau complex, along with many other camps of the Reich, housed tens of thousands of inmates. The Gulag, on the other hand, had by then engulfed millions. Hitler had murdered scores of his political opponents, but this paled before the massive bloodletting of Stalin's great purges in terms of numbers. Millions had already perished in the state-induced famine in Ukraine. In sum, Stalinism's body count of the decade which preceded the opening salvos of the Second World War exceeded that of Nazism more than a hundredfold. In 1940, the USSR became the first belligerent to carry out a systematic murder of Allied POWs, who were, it should be recalled, wore the uniforms of a member of the Anti-Fascist Alliance. This atrocity was accompanied by massive Soviet repression directed against the civilians of eastern Poland. Perhaps the more perceptive would guess at the horrors yet to come. Ponary, Babi Yar, gas chambers, Auschwitz, Treblinka. But at least in 1940, and perhaps as late as June 21st of 1941, you didn't have to be much of a fascist sympathizer to conclude which of the two regimes was worse. All you had to do was be able to count numbers. Now, of course, if I presented such a narrow slice of history to be taken seriously as a sort of a general proposition, it would be certainly even offensive. It would be offensive to the millions of victims of National Socialism. So, and that is because, of course, on June 22, 1941, the world changed forever in a way which we all are aware of. And Central and Eastern Europe became the slaughterhouse unparalleled I would argue not even for the 20th century, but for all of human history. And certainly, Nazism very quickly equaled and surpassed Stalinism's mass murder count in terms of comparing Nazism and communism. Now, when we look at historical issues, there are several things we have to consider. Why is it then so difficult to talk about this topic, particularly under commemorative circumstances such as May 9th? Let us, however, remember one thing in particular when talking about history and comparing it to memory. History is not the same thing. Commemorative occasions, as you gather, are occasions in which group loyalty is reinforced. It is at heart, in the broadest sense, a political act. It is not historical analysis. In fact, commemorations tend to be hostile towards any form of historical analysis, which tends to recognize shades of gray and various difficulties and complexities. Now, we know, for example, that we have a great deal of conflicting narratives concerning World War II. Let me mention just a few detailed items. First of all, the very language in which the war is described, I will just mention two examples, is very different from the perspectives of, let's say, Baltic citizens, Lithuanians, Latvians, or Estonians, and, for example, those people who fought on the Soviet side in World War II, or were, in fact, as Jews, liberated by the Soviet side in World War II. Two examples. One is, of course, the term anti-fascist, which carries a positive and wonderful connotation for most people, West and East. But I have to tell you that for my parents' generation, the only anti-fascists they ever met were Stalinists. And so, therefore, that word never carried any positive connotation. This isn't simply a matter of language differences. It is a difference of the experience of the people themselves. The second example concerns the fact of understanding the very chronology of the war. In the West, 1939 is the beginning, and May 9th or 8th, depending on which you choose to pick, is the end. But I've done the research. In my father's village in that area, in that district, there were very few Jews. And in fact, more people died violently after May 9, 45 than before, up till about 1950. And this is true, I'm sure. If I did the research in parts of West Ukraine elsewhere, it would be true of other parts of Eastern Europe. And so, therefore, people's memories, their historical narratives that they teach themselves, is different not only because we use words differently. In fact, in Lithuanian, there's a word, pokaris, which means after war. It's a kind of a phrase used commonly. And the word after war is a word of violence. It commemorates the fact that more ethnic Lithuanians were slaughtered after 1945 than during the Second World War. Now, the other thing that has to be considered from different perspectives, in other words, I am not a great optimist that we can ever share a history together. We all share a past, yes. The events are the events. If the tree falls and those and there's no one to hear it, it still falls. But history is about narratives, and these narratives have to be different based on people's historical perspectives and also scholarly analysis. I think the other thing why this issue is so difficult is because it brings to the fore the obvious moral ethical issues. Millions of people were murdered by both regimes. Some in the 1930s, some in the 1940s. How this is remembered and how this is analyzed brings to the core these moral ethical issues. And one of the factors I would like for us to remember is some people behave as if on June 22, 1941, the Kremlin suddenly ceased being a criminal regime by some magic wand, and that it became again a criminal regime on May 9, 1945. And the intervening period, somehow, the admittedly enormous contribution of Soviet citizenry and its armed forces in the defeat of fascism and Nazism, not to speak of the liberation of the concentration camps of Eastern Europe, somehow is, Catholics would understand this, somehow is redemption from the other massive crimes. I don't particularly buy this perspective. I don't think it is very helpful. But I can understand why it would have such force in terms of trying to remember the Second World War. Now, finally, we also have to speak about the comparative history and its approaches in several very specific ways. There are two issues, I think, which have come up, and here perhaps there's a relationship to the current political discussion that is going on, sometimes very intensely, in the Baltic capitals, in Moscow, in St. Petersburg, and all over Eastern Europe, about the meaning of World War II, and also the efforts by the Russian government, particularly through this Medvedev Commission, dominated by the security services, to impose a narrative to actually criminalize alternate narratives of World War II in a very, I think, particularly nasty way. And so we're faced with this question of comparative history. I think two aspects of it, one specific and one general. First of all, the real story of the story of 1939 to 1941, when the Soviet Union was not exactly an ally of Nazi Germany. There was no formal treaty of alliance, but there was a tactical arrangement directed against the West, while Britain fought all alone at that point against the fascist peace. And I think that the interpretation of this period has to be looked at quite closely by future historians, and it is being done now. That is one issue I think that we have to talk about and that we have to consider closely. Actually, we know from German records that Nazi Germany, between the period of the signing of the Ribbentrop Pact and also the summer of 1941, their own records indicate that they considered Soviet economic assistance to be of maybe not critical, but of extremely important aspect of their general war plans directed against the West. A little aside to this that might interest you is that in the spring of 1940, as the Soviet government was preparing the occupation of the Baltic states, one of the accusations they leveled against Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia was that they were too pro-British. This is often forgotten in the way the narrative of the war is remembered later. The other, I think, and I'll end with this because I don't want to hog the time, and I know that in these kinds of situations it's easy to talk past one's allotted time period, is the whole issue that has been brought up recently, particularly in Eastern Europe, the question of the comparative merits or comparative crimes, rather, of communism and Nazism in general. And here I think this particular issue became very political last summer when I was in Vilnius, and the parliamentary session of the OCSC was being held there, and it actually broke out into the open in a very angry debate, which caused the Speaker of Lithuanian Parliament, Mr. Valiūnas, to walk out in protest, between Russian accusations that the comparison of communism and Nazism simply cannot be allowed, and the insistence by Lithuanians and supported by Poles and other East Europeans that such a comparison is essential. I think there is a difference between equating two systems and the very legitimate scholarly activity of comparative history, which is quite another thing. Here I would like to conclude with a thought, I think, that when we compare these two systems, we have to be very clear about what we are comparing exactly. When we talk about the Stalinist regime and its mass murder period, which I would begin with the late 1920s, early 1930s, and continuing onward, and we compare that with the Nazi genocide, particularly of the Jews, Roma, and, of course, massive killings of Polish citizens, for example, not only them, then we are involved in the death of millions of people. My proposition that I would put forth is that I do not think that we can characterize Soviet mass murder as genocide. I think the genocide, in a scholarly sense, the definition of it does not apply. On the other hand, from an ethical or moral perspective, I fail to see any difference whatever between the mass murder of millions and the genocide of millions as a human proposition of actually killing people who are innocent and defenseless. So here we have several issues. Some deal with scholarship. Others deal with the ethical implications of that. I had a long paper that I had put together particularly on this issue for publication elsewhere, but this would be too long to read, and after all, it wouldn't be, I think, relevant to this point, but I would like to read the last paragraph, if I may. And it's simply my point of view, not shared by, I'm sure, many others. It is unfortunate that the great patriotic war narrative is now too often invoked as a kind of fig leaf to deflect discussion from the huge costs inflicted by the Soviet regime on its own people. The Kremlin was the seat of a criminal regime. This reality did not magically vanish on June 22, 1941, nor did it suddenly resume after a hiatus on May 9, 1945. The heroism and sacrifice of the Soviet people in defeating Nazism is trivialized and diminished when it is employed as a political weapon to legitimize the Stalinist system, to serve Russian geopolitical interests, or to drown discussion of the crimes of a failed philosophy. This is a sensitive and difficult issue for many non-Jewish East Europeans. It is maddening and counterintuitive in the complex emotions it engenders. It is difficult to appreciate for those outside the experience. In the hindsight of over a half century, people who argue that Soviet victory was preferable to Nazi conquest are probably right. Respect is due the dead and the heroes. Yet the current inhabitants of this historically most devastated region of the world have the right to plead, please spare us any more stories of red liberation. Save us from compulsory expressions of effusive gratitude. In hindsight, the aging victims of Stalinism and their heirs may have to grudgingly accept that the rescue from fascism and the decades of consequent suffering under the Kremlin paved the road to a democratic future in a united Europe. But the price they paid is not something they should be asked to celebrate. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, thanks very much, Saulius. We'll go straight over to Nina.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your excellent presentation. I'm really not an expert on Katyn, of course. Janusz was very generous. What I mentioned to him is that I find Russian-Polish relations very important for the reason that basically Russia's relations with the West is centered around Poland, and also there is a question of Russian identity that is also very much tied to Poland, and that's why I think Katyn obviously has an even greater significance than it would have probably with another country, although we wouldn't know. What I wanted to start with is that a year ago, exactly actually a year ago, just last May, there was a presidential commission established, and the commission, Russian presidential commission, President Medvedev was overseeing that, is overseeing it, to investigate cases of historical revisionism of World War II. And the cases were considered the ones that are unfavorable to Russia. The case of 1939, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. The second one is indeed that Katyn massacre, whether it was a Nazi's fault that in 1940 over 20,000 Polish officers and priests and the Polish elite, as they say, was either slaughtered by the Nazis or was slaughtered by the NKVD, the predecessor of KGB, Stalin's secret police. And also liberation of Europe, whether the Soviet Union was a liberator of Eastern Europe, but were actually an occupier of Eastern Europe. So these were the three major cases that the commission was to investigate. The argument for the Molotov-Ribbentrop case, and the reason actually you can imagine, because last year was the anniversary of the pact, and therefore this commission was very timely and important, because the arguments were made that, of course, Stalin had no other choice but signing that. I mean, Molotov had no other choice but signing that for Stalin, because basically the only thing that the Soviet Union was doing at the time is with regaining territories that used to be the Russian Empire, which, you know, kind of a flimsy explanation. I mean, the fact that it was a Soviet Empire doesn't necessarily mean that it has to take all the territories of the former empire, but yet it was offered as a reason, and that in itself was not entirely correct, because we have a representative from the Moldova Foundation in 1940 when the Soviets kicked out the Romanians from Bessarabia and occupied the northern Bukovina at the time, which actually was never part of the empire. So that in itself was slightly slightly confusing, and yet it was really given as a historical fact. One of the reasons behind that is that in 2004, and I really don't need to go into recent Russian history, but in 2004, then-President Putin, as you know now, he is prime minister as of 2008, but in 2004, he was still president in his second term. Russia was great, and he really decided that Russia is great. Stalin is even greater, and history is entirely on the Russian side, which is Russia has nothing to regret as great as it is. So the firm belief since 2004 that the Russian people are the liberators of Europe, and there is no other way of looking at it. And then the Katyn was certainly the Nazis' fault, and of course the Soviets had nothing to do with that. And in fact, that was kind of an interesting, well, it wasn't entirely that interesting, but very disappointing development, because when Mikhail Gorbachev started his perestroika and glasnost, it was well established that, in fact, the Katyn massacre was the case of the Soviets, and then Yeltsin continued on, and, you know, 10 years later, we back to square one, that is, back to this kind of Stalin era mythology and Soviet mythology that you know, the Katyn is in fact our fault. What interests me today is that 12 months later, so now it's 2010, May 2010, Katyn is back as what it was in 1940, and then back what it became in history in the late 1980s and then in the 1990s, which is Stalin's NKVD slaughter. And Putin himself admitted it. And, you know, of course, Russia being Russia, so there's always this conflicting narratives and there's always qualifications because ultimately we're never guilty. And the qualification, as you may remember, was that, yes, Stalin was it was horrible, but yet Stalin was avenging his own troops that the Polish slaughtered 10 years prior, as if, you know, that tragedy, of course, could kind of even it up. But anyway, at least there was an admission, finally, yet again. So what happened in a year is that Stalin is no longer as great as he was. Even as great as he was in the fall of 2009, you may remember that in Moscow, Kurskaya Station, Moscow subway Kurskaya Station, was refurbished with his name on display, and in fact, it is there in shining golden letters. So don't get me wrong, Stalin is still great, but he also got qualified, which is kind of a step forward. That is, it was admitted, and President Medvedev admitted it himself a few times, that he's finally now called a dictator. But, of course, he was good for his people because, you know, Second World War. And then, as you know, in Russia, it's a great patriotic war. So, well, the rest of the world actually fought the global war. Russia particularly, Soviet Union particularly, fought our own war. Almost sort of us against all. So there was still these two conflicting narratives that seem not to be conflicting at all. So he was a dictator, but that was good nonetheless. So if you ask me why the change, and that's what basically what I work on is the sort of contemporary politics and culture, is that I actually think the economic crisis really made the Russians running. And in a sense, there was, since the fall, there was an understanding that, remember that great Soviet slogan, building communism in a separately taken country? I think there was a decision that you cannot really fight a global crisis, economic crisis, in a separately taken country. So Russia started acting in slightly civilized manner. So I don't know if this is permanent, because I actually find Russians' behavior after the not only with the admission of Katyn, but after Lech Kaczynski, President Kaczynski, and his colleagues tragically died almost un-Russian, or certainly un-Putin Russian. So I don't know whether it was going to last, or maybe if the oil goes up again, we're going to back to our great self again. I don't know. But yet, I think it's a very important change that has happened. And hopefully, we're not going to go back to that Russia is great, unqualified. This panel, and I will conclude with that, is called The Power of Truth. And I think what really is more important with the Russians or with Russia altogether is that it's not that it's not capable of telling the truth. I mean, the facts are there and often are there. But even when it tells the truth, there are all these qualifications. You know, the facts are this, but there is, on the other hand. And I think for Russia from now on, and I hope it may happen, is more important than admitting the truth, because that has been done. I mean, with Katyn, indeed, was done by Gorbachev and Yeltsin, and back again to what Katyn really was. But it's the admission of guilt, and I think that's where we really have work to do quite a bit. The mea culpa is really something that that really... that hasn't worked worked out with us as much. One of the things I wanted to conclude with, I don't know if how fresh you remember Nikita Khrushchev's memoirs, but there was a very interesting document because, as you know, desalinization started there and then, and it was a good step forward. And yet when you read the memoir, it was sort of Stalin was this and the 20 million people died and the Second World War, in fact, was problematic because before the war started, the military, Russian military elite, Soviet military elite was slaughtered and therefore there were immense losses. And yet Khrushchev concludes almost every single paragraph is that, but... all in all, Stalin was really very important for the world communist movement, and therefore he was very important. All in all, he was an important leader for Russia. And I think that that's what the major problem in Russia is, that we're still there, that we the truth and the facts should be stripped of the mythology that makes us look good, and in fact, the admission of guilt would be something that we should go forward with. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Nina. We'll go straight over to Vladimir.
Thank you. And as became very clear with Nina's presentation...
You have plenty of time, actually. They've given
okay.
you a lot of time. Yeah.
Thank you. they have indeed, and thanks. And as is clear by now, and as the famous saying goes, Russia's a country with an unpredictable past. And every new regime in different periods of time seemed to be rewriting the narrative to suit their own aims. And in the early 1990s, as thousands of Muscovites were toppling down the statue of Felix Dzerzhinsky, the founder of Cheka, and as the red flag was lowered for the very last time over the Kremlin, it seemed that finally with the end of the Soviet regime came the end of Soviet lies and falsifications. And in fact, in 1992, for several months, there was a court case in the Russian Constitutional Court, a court case against the Communist Party. For this case, there were thousands of archival documents declassified and published, and this was actually mainly the demand of Vladimir Bukovsky, who was already mentioned, and who was invited by the Yeltsin administration to be the chief expert at this trial of the Communist Party, and he demanded that these documents be declassified and opened, and they're actually on the web published today thanks to his efforts back then. But the case carried on for several months, and all these documents proving the purges, the repression, the arrests, the killings, the deportation, all these other crimes of the Soviet communist regime were opened up. And the case ended in November 1992 with a verdict of the handed down by the court. It was an ordinance which received number 9P, and it was dated November the 30th, 1992. One of the findings was, and I quote, governing structures of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union were initiators of the policies of repression directed at millions, end of quote. And this was not just a moral judgment, it was a judicial decision by the highest judicial authority in Russia. So communism was condemned not just morally, but I guess legally. And it was from then on that all the information on crimes against, crimes against its own people committed by the communist regime were uncovered, and all these mass graves in Butovo and Levashova and Komunarka and all these others were opened up and openly discussed after decades of silence. And at the same time, crimes committed against other nations, against other peoples, were also uncovered and discussed and publicized. And, of course, the secret protocol of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, for instance, which was, you know, its existence was denied for years and decades. And it, in the waning days of the Soviet Union in the end of 1989, the Soviet legislature, the Council of People's Deputies, not only admitted its existence, but it passed a resolution condemning the pact and declaring it null and void. The same goes for Katyn, which was already discussed. The Soviet leadership admitted in 1990 during Jaruzelski's visit to Moscow, the Polish president, that Katyn was not, in fact, committed by the Nazis, as was claimed ever since the 1940s, but it was committed by Stalin's NKVD forces. Documents were not declassified back then by Mr. Gorbachev. It took the end of the Soviet Union, and it took the new Russian president, Boris Yeltsin, who declassified the Katyn documents, including the famous note from Beria to the Politburo suggesting the, that these 22,000 Polish officers be disposed with. And in 92, President Yeltsin handed these documents to Lech Walesa's Polish government. And a year later, in 1993, President Yeltsin issued an apology on behalf of the Russian people to the Polish people for what happened in Katyn, and he went to the Katyn Memorial in Warsaw and laid a wreath with the words, "Forgive us." That was on a state visit in 1993. And I think apart from being the obviously morally right thing to do, it's also a sign of strength to give apology where apology is due. It's actually been, turning now to the Baltic states, another topic that was discussed in the first presentation. Going back to the 19th century, the Russian society, the Russian educated society, the Russian intelligentsia had the tradition of sympathizing with the oppressed peoples, and you know, under the understanding that no people that oppresses other peoples can be free itself. And we see figures like Gierzen, Agariov, Bielinski openly sympathizing, for instance, with the Polish struggle for autonomy in the 19th century, and the famous slogan, "For your freedom and ours, za waszą naszą swobodę," it was coined by Gierzen, and it was addressed to the Poles in the 19th century, and then of course, famously became the slogan of the dissident movement in the Soviet Union itself in the 20th century. And so what we saw in 1990 and 1991, when there were initially tens and eventually hundreds of thousands of people coming out at anti-communist rallies in Moscow and Leningrad and other large cities and protesting against the regime and demanding freedom, they were not only demanding freedom for themselves, they were demanding freedom for other oppressed peoples. And you saw, for instance, at the biggest demonstration in 1990 with 500,000 people organized by the Democratic Russia movement in Moscow. Russian demonstrators in Moscow came out not just with the tricolor flags of Russia, which was then banned, of course, but also with the flags that also banned flags of independent Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and all these other countries. These were Russian demonstrators in Moscow in 1990. In January 91, when the Soviet leadership sent tanks to Vilnius to crush the nascent independence movement, President, or then Speaker of the Parliament, Yeltsin, went to Vilnius demonstratively and on a solidarity mission and met with Landsbergis and other pro-independence figures and actually signed agreements on cooperation with them, thus sabotaging the planned blockade of the Baltic states, which was being planned in the Kremlin at the time. And it's also very, very important, especially in the context of the current revisionism and what was discussed here before, that in 91, in two binding treaties signed between Yeltsin and Landsbergis in Lithuania and Yeltsin and Rutil in Estonia, the Russian government, never the Soviet Union, but the Russian government officially acknowledged the fact of the forceful annexation of the Baltic states in 1940. So whatever Mr. Putin's revisionists say now, and you know, they basically got back to the Soviet line that the Baltic states joined voluntarily in 1940, the government of Russia, the democratically elected government of Russia in 1991, recognized the fact of the annexation, and it cannot be taken back. Of course, 10 years ago, Mr. Yeltsin was replaced in the Kremlin by a former KGB colonel who publicly stated that the peaceful dissolution of the Soviet Empire was, quote, the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. And mind you, that's the century where horrible genocides and wars and many other horrible things happened, and he called that, he singled out that as the greatest catastrophe. Of course, Mr. Bukovsky and other of our colleagues in the Russian pro-democracy movement say, you know, we consider that there's a bit of a difference in perspective because we consider the creation of the Soviet Union the greatest geopolitical catastrophe. He thinks it was the dissolution. And sure enough, with many practices of the old regime, like media censorship and falsified elections and political prisoners came many symbols of the Soviet past. Nina already mentioned the Stalin inscription in the Moscow metro. That was, of course, one of the first acts of Mr. Putin was to return the Stalinist national anthem as the national anthem of Russia over numerous protests in the year 2000. The memorial plaque of Yuri Andropov, who was chairman of the KGB and mastermind of the campaign of persecution against political dissidents, and he was the architect of the infamous punitive psychiatry strategies. His plaque was restored by Mr. Putin on Lubyanka in Moscow. In fact, there were new monuments erected to Mr. Andropov in Rybinsk and Petrozavodsk during the Putin decade. And in the new school textbooks approved by the Russian Education Ministry, the mass Stalinist purges of the 1930s were called, quote, adequate to the tasks of modernization, end quote, when describing that period. And Stalin himself was described as an effective manager. So this kind of creeping re-Sovietization, you know, was the hallmark of this Putin decade. And of course, the Victory Day also was not spared this process. And earlier this year, the authorities in Moscow announced that for the first time in half a century, the Russian capital will be draped with official portraits of Joseph Stalin, because apparently, you know, the celebrations would be incomplete without the, quote, commander-in-chief, and, you know, he was an integral part of the victory, so he must be celebrated. Of course, a tremendous insult to the memory of millions and millions of victims of Stalinist terror, and the first of those victims was, of course, the Russian people, which numerically was the biggest victim of communist repressions. You know, the millions of peasants, priests, monks shot dead, writers, engineers, millions and millions of people killed. And this was also an insult to the veterans of the war who defeated Nazism, because by trying to link somehow the victory over Nazis to the defense and the justification of Stalin's regime, it suggests that people were not fighting and dying for their country, for their loved ones, for their children, for their homes, but they were somehow fighting and dying for the Gulag, the Kolkhoz, and the Stalinist regime, which is, in my view, the greatest insult you can issue to World War II veterans whom this regime is supposedly protecting and honoring this week, and, you know, especially this year, the 65th anniversary. There were numerous protests against the decision by opposition groups, by human rights organizations, by NGOs, and indeed by the veterans themselves. There was a letter from veterans to Lushkov, Moscow mayor, saying this is completely unacceptable. I just want to quote a couple of these statements. This one is from Solidarity, the democratic opposition group led by Boris Nemtsov and Garry Kasparov. I quote, "Our people won the war in spite of Stalin, not because of him. We consider the placing of the butcher's portraits on Victory Day a blasphemy," end of quote. The decision was called offensive and immoral. This decision condemns hundreds of thousands of Muscovites to commemorate Victory Day with feelings of bitterness and hurt instead of joy, end of quote. Yabloko, the Russian Democratic Party, founded by Grigory Yavlinsky, quote, "Posters of Stalin are an insult to the memory of our fathers, grandfathers, and great-grandfathers who earned victory over Nazism by their blood and their toil. This decision shows hatred towards the Russian people and other peoples whose genocide was perpetrated by Stalin," end of quote. And even the hierarchy of the Russian Orthodox Church, which on most occasions is usually very loyal to the government, tries not to create conflicts with the powers that be. In the past few years, there are only two instances when the Russian Orthodox Church hierarchy went against the government. The first one was back in 2008 when the late Patriarch Alexei II refused to follow the government in canonically recognizing South Ossetia and Abkhazia separate from Georgia. He actually stated that the Russian Church considers the Abkhazian and South Ossetian churches to be canonical territory of the Georgian Orthodox Church. That was in fall of 2008. And the second instance was just actually this week, when there was a statement issued by the Moscow Patriarchate, which read, this was concerning the authorities' plans to put up pictures of Stalin. Quote, "Stalin built an inhuman system which cannot be justified by anything, not even by victory in the Great Patriotic War. It was achieved by our people, not by Stalin," end of quote. As part of the civil society protest and campaign against this, there were counter posters prepared by, among other groups, the Russian Memorial Society, which honors victims of Stalinism and communism. Placards like this, which were printed and they were supposed to be put next to the government-installed pictures of Stalin, and these kind of short illustrative messages like this intended to remind people of the purges, of the killings, of the collectivization. And indeed, since the government tried to make the case that Stalin was such a great commander and indispensable to our victory against the Nazis, putting up posters, actually reminding people of his incompetence and his criminal incompetence in the war, especially in the first month. This poster, for instance, this reads, of course, the official slogan was «За родину за Сталина», «For a motherland for Stalin», and these posters put by Memorial, they read «За родину без Сталина», «For a motherland against Stalin». And this is this poster shows a copy, a facsimile of Stalin's handwritten resolution. This was when Soviet intelligence kept reporting to him that the Germans are preparing an attack. And every time he would dismiss this as disinformation because he trusted, you know, his partners, his German partners with whom he had signed the pact in 1939. And this particular resolution reads that, this is Timur Kulov, head of the intelligence, it reads that, why don't you put your source and then a popular Russian expletive. And these were the counter posters prepared. There were, in fact, some posters that went up, not in Moscow, but in Syktyvkar, in the north of Russia, in the Komi region. Within hours, it was defaced with ketchup, with red all over it. There was another image of Stalin put up on a passenger bus in St. Petersburg, and within hours, that was defaced to painted over. And last week, a few days ago, the deputy mayor of Moscow, Madame Shevtsova, announced that the government had reconsidered its decision and that the posters of Stalin will not be put on the Moscow streets, quote, for the fear of vandalism, end quote. And because they realized that these pictures wouldn't even last, you know, 2 hours after they were put up. They'd be defaced, they'd be painted over, they'd be broken, they'd be all these other posters would be put up, or there'd be maybe fights between people, you know, next to them. So this was actually a very rare, very important victory of civil society in Russia over the regime. Not very many of those in the last few years, but this was certainly one. So in concluding, I'd just like to say that, you know, state the obvious. The Russian people and other peoples of the former Soviet Union can be rightfully proud of the immense contribution to the defeat of Nazism and the genuine liberation of the Jewish people, for instance, who were destined to certain death in Nazi-dominated Europe. It's a source of rightful pride that, you know, it was Russian soldiers who opened the doors of Auschwitz in January 1945 and the other German death camps. And over three-quarters of the Nazis' losses in terms of casualties and equipment losses were on the Eastern Front. So it's absolutely certain that Nazism was defeated primarily by the Soviet Union. But at the same time, we must tell the whole truth. And it would be both untruthful and immoral not to recognize that many states in Central and Eastern Europe in 1945 exchanged one occupying power for another. It would be untruthful and immoral for us not to recognize the mass deportations, the killings, the arrests, the falsified elections that installed pro-Soviet puppet regimes in those countries. And indeed, it would be untruthful and immoral not to recognize that the Russian people, the victors themselves, came back in 1945 to witness a new wave in Stalinist purges, which began in 1946-47, and many thousands of those soldiers who defeated Nazism came home and were sent back to the Stalinist gulag in the labor camps in the east, in Siberia and east of the Urals. There's absolutely no reason why the Russian people and the Russian state should be making apologies for a criminal totalitarian regime of which it was itself the biggest victim. And this truth is what the democratically elected Russian leaders said out loud in the 1990s. And it is, I believe, the truth that despite the best efforts of the current regime, a great many people in Russia today know, remember, and acknowledge as we prepare to celebrate the 65th anniversary of our victory. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Vladimir. I've just heard news that we will be linked with Mr. Snorre in Latvia in a few minutes, but let's take a couple of questions because we have to take then a break to set up technical stuff. So let's take a couple of quick questions for our panelists, please. If you could introduce yourself, Dan, as well.
Yeah.
I think that's one of a very few good signs, because there was big resistance to it, as you obviously know. And, you know, people were saying, how can you have NATO troops on Red Square? And, you know, people were reminding, it's not NATO troops. This is the anti-Hitler coalition troops. And this was one of the surprisingly good signs, which we also have to acknowledge. The other one was President Medvedev's decision 2 weeks ago to publish facsimile copies of the scans of the documents on Katyn on the Russian government website, the Federal Archives Service. And actually the website was jammed because there were so many people trying to access it. It's now back working again. So this is a very good decision, I think, and it's in the vein of the 50th anniversary celebrations, which you remember, I think you were working in Moscow at that time, right, in 95, when there was a real, no attempt at Sovietization, Stalinization. In fact, President Yeltsin ordered that all the Soviet symbols be draped over on Red Square when President Clinton came and Prime Minister Major came and all the Allied leaders back in 1995. So this is one of the few more encouraging signs regarding this anniversary celebration. Well, for instance, the biggest one, in 95, all the Allied leaders, Yeltsin, Clinton, and Major, the three big ones, they were standing by the mausoleum, mm-hmm. and Yeltsin ordered that the name Lenin be closed up so it wouldn't be seen anywhere. Of course, now it will be in full display.
Nina, do you want to?
No, I think Vladimir said it all, but it kind of goes to what I was trying to say, that I think since this fall, they've been running for their lives with a crisis, and I think somehow the crisis was good for Russia's civilizing behavior. I mean, something that Vladimir really did a great presentation of what how bad the regime is, but also at the same time, they allowed the Gulag Archipelago, Alexander Solzhenitsyn's book, to be read in high school, together with the new history that Stalin was a great manager of his people, which, of course, is a positive sign, but on the other hand, is incredibly reflexive of what Russia really is, which is a split personality disorder, very much represented in the national symbol of the two-headed eagle. So I think it seems like the Western eagle is winning right now, but we don't know how long that victory will last and what will happen to the eastern part.
And on the subject of this split personality, we always say that St. Petersburg is located in the Leningrad region, even today. So that's another illustration.
Stanley Kovar with the Cato Institute. The theologian Abraham Joshua Heschel said that in a free society, only a few are guilty, but all are responsible. And I've argued that means the First Amendment here in the United States means that we not only have the right to information, but the obligation to know. We cannot say we did not know what the government did in our name. Okay. What about in an unfree society? I remember being a student in the Soviet Union, conversation with a Russian student praising Stalin. And when she finished, I said, yes, okay, he led the country to victory in war. But didn't he also kill a lot of people? She seemed troubled by this question, not offended, but troubled, and replied slowly, yes, that's true. But what do you do with people who oppose the revolution? Of course you kill them. I was there with some British students. We were shocked. We said, no, you don't do that. And to her credit, she took that on board. She was, she was surprised that there could be another way. It was like this was all that she had been taught, and now she was being exposed to a different point of view that she had some difficulty understanding. So this is my question. In an unfree society, or say take Russia now, not quite a free society, no First Amendment, it's not Stalinism. So in between, what is the responsibility of the ordinary people?
Actually, Salius, you want to tackle?
Yeah, I heard once a scholar say that if a person lives in a polluted city, you can hardly blame him for developing emphysema. I mean, there is, in an unfree society, there is this problem. I mean, and I think therefore the question of responsibility has to be dealt with there with some finesse. But I would remind you that it doesn't take a Soviet teacher to talk that way. You know that Eric Hobsbawm, the benighted, much acclaimed British historian, was asked in an interview just a few years ago why he did not reject communism. And he, during that interview, he said that it would be an appropriate price to have killed 15 to 20, it was in the millions, the number, I don't recall the number, but something like 10 to 15 million people if the revolution succeeded in its aims. That is, if it did achieve the utopia that it had promised, then it would be okay. And this is certainly not a person who grew up in any kind of, you know, unfree society. So I think sometimes what's most troubling is not, to me, are not the unfree people who don't have a chance often to think freely, but of intellectuals who, throughout the 20th century, highly educated people have adopted utopian aims and essentially with the idea that the ends justify the means. I think in Kessler's Darkness at Noon, the last few pages, I think, show that quite brilliantly.
Well, there's a book by Goldhagen, Hitler's Willing Executioners, that's obviously on Germany, but it was also about the complicity of just ordinary Germans in the Holocaust. You know, people just say, we didn't know anything was happening, and you know, he's asking basically, so where do you think all these, you know, Jewish children went from your town when just disappeared in the trains? What did you think was happening? And it's a very difficult question. Saudi just said, how do you hold everybody responsible? But that was one of the main reasons that people like Galina Starovoitova and Vladimir Bukovsky and others back in 91, 92, when the Soviet system collapsed, were demanding a kind of a symbolic trial, Nuremberg style, on the Communist Party, not to, you know, imprison anyone or, you know, to punish anyone, but just to open everything up and to undergo this kind of moral cleansing for the whole society, to see what we lived through and what, you know, some maybe participated in just by their passivity and unwillingness to or inability to protest. And this was, of course, not done. There was no real condemnation of the Lenin-Stalin ideology, as there was the case that I mentioned, the Constitutional Court case, but it didn't go far enough. There were no real lustrations. There were not really an opening, complete opening of all the archival documents to make sure, you know, this moral cleansing would be achieved, and there would never be any going back, and that it would be impossible for any Russian president, whatever his own or her own views, to restore the Stalinist national anthem as the national anthem of Russia, you know. So this is a very difficult question, and I think the method that they proposed, it's probably the best way of achieving this, but it wasn't done, so, and we're seeing the results of that now as well, I think.
Nina, any thoughts on this question?
Everything so eloquent. So I think we're all responsible in a free society, and in a free society, if you're going to be killed anyway, you might as well protest your killing. Instead of going into the gulag, because very few protested. And I know it sounds very brutal and cruel, but that, you know, has finally been my understanding, that that's you might as well stand up for what you are. And I think in Russia, for example, there is a problem because there's always this division of us versus them. It's them who did it, and they didn't know, or we didn't know. And I think before we take responsibility, that is our nation and our people and our relatives, I mean, you know, my relatives, certainly were part of it, and try to do mea culpa as imperfectly as they did. But yet, I think we're still going to have problems of narrative and understanding and mythology. But ultimately, it's everybody's responsibility.
Hold your questions for a few minutes. We're going to have a five-minute break. We'll put on, we'll do the technical stuff so we can link in with Latvia. We'll have Edvin speak, and then we can ask him a few questions, then come back to our panelists. So don't go away. Just take a break, grab a coffee. Please take your seats. Latvia's waiting. Edvin's, okay. This is Janusz Bugajski. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, wonderful. I think we're almost all seated. First of all, I've already introduced you, so I'm not going to go into more details, but I want to first of all congratulate you on the film, which I saw a few weeks ago. I had managed to get a copy.
Thank you.
And I'm encouraging everybody else to view it as well. I think it's been shown during the Baltic days, right, in Washington these days.
Mm-hmm.
I believe so. I believe it has been shown, but I'm sure it will be more widely. Edwin, in case we get cut off, we never know how long these Icelandic volcanoes or whatever other technical problems may happen. But why don't you speak for a few minutes, give us your thoughts about the film, also about the significance, how you see the upcoming Victory Day celebrations in Moscow, particularly from a Latvian perspective. And maybe if there's time, a few questions from our audience.
Okay. Well, I did not hear what the previous speakers said, so I will probably repeat some of their opinions. But yes, this year we celebrate, or Russia celebrates, the 65th anniversary since the victory of the Soviet Union in the Second World War. And I think I will not be original to say that that victory did not bring freedom to the countries the Soviet Union liberated, at least most of the countries, for example, Latvia. Because the Soviet army did not leave after that liberation, but stayed, and not only stayed, but committed crimes and genocide in those countries, for example, in Latvia. So I think this should be remembered when we talk about this anniversary this year. And I also think that we should remember that this is not only the 65th anniversary this year, but also 70th anniversary since other major event in that war, which is Katyn massacre, when the Soviet Union ordered killing of more than 20,000 unarmed people in Katyn. So I think that these things should be viewed in context. And we can't celebrate one thing without remembering the other. But despite this fact, I think that there are many people in Russia still who deny the criminal nature of the regime which won in that war and their crimes. We can see it not only in the Russian mass media, but also in the parliament. And still, after these 70 years of half-truth and denials, Russia still denies full access to the archive materials relating to the Katyn massacre, only releasing some of the materials and only partly, in portions. Yes, I can say that there have been progress at the same time. There have. And we know that Russian television, for example, demonstrated via this film, Katyn, quite recently. But it also aired discussion after that screening. And I viewed that discussion. And it was interesting to see that people who participated there, they stated that it was not possible to reveal the names of those NKVD murderers for the humane purposes, as they said it, because their children and grandchildren could experience psychological trauma and feel embarrassed. So I think that the reluctance to come to terms with the truth can be felt still in Russia. It is still there. And the Russian regime, the Kremlin, is not ready to admit that the Soviet Union was a criminal, the criminal regime, and that the Soviet Union during the Second World War was not killing only the Nazis. It was killing also Poles. It was attacking Finland, and it was invading the Baltics. So I think that it would be for the benefit of the Russian war veterans who actually fought in the front line for the truth to be established. I also think that it would be in their interest to identify those KGB veterans who use this event of this 65th anniversary, who use this event to be there as well and to flash their medals, probably, which were not in the front line, but in Gulag and possibly in Katyn. Well, these are my thoughts about it.
Okay, thanks very much. Any chance of your film being shown in Russia?
Well, it has been shown on the internet. It has been translated in Russian and shown in the internet. It can be available. It is available there. But well, I have no illusions that it will be shown in Russian television anytime soon.
Mm-hmm. Any questions, by the way, for Edvins from our audience or from our panelists or sponsors? Nadia, any question? This is Nadia McConnell.
Hello, Edvins.
Hello.
We're sorry that you couldn't be with us in person, but we look forward to you coming back to Washington sometime.
Yes, I'm sorry as well. Well, it turned out that way.
As you look forward in terms of this commemoration and some of your work, I guess your PhD work, in the role of the West in terms of either acknowledging or helping the Soviets deny this part of history, do you have any comments about that?
Well, I think that the West actually took part in, I talked about the Katyn massacre. The West took part in concealing that crime after the Second World War. For example, in the Nuremberg trials, it was actually the Soviet Union wanted to discuss it and to put the blame on the Nazis. It was not done eventually by the Nuremberg trials, but nevertheless, it was not also they did not say who was the actual murderer and who was the actual perpetrator. So I think that there is partly responsibility also in the West, and I'm not speaking about my PhD is about Ukrainian famine in 1930s, so and especially about the role of the West so their reaction to that famine, and yes. They knew that the famine was happening, but did not do anything about it, essentially.
Edvins, this is Janos again. I presume there will be a Latvian government delegation in Moscow for the celebrations. What's being said about it, if anything, on Latvian television or by a Latvian government?
Well, there are different opinions about it. There are those who support it and say that it is a correct step. But I think that majority of the Latvian people do not support it, and I do not support it either. And I think it is wrong for the Latvian president to be there, and especially for the Latvian president, because those countries who were invaded by the Soviet Union and who were experiencing that Soviet rule and genocide against their nations were few, and they were exactly Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, and also countries in Eastern Europe. And I think that we know the best. We know very well what was the Soviet Union and the Soviet regime. So I think it is surprising and unacceptable for me that our president is there.
Okay, Edvins, I don't know if there are other questions. Let me quickly turn to the floor in case somebody wants to ask. Okay, I think that's it for now. It's the end of the day, by the way, end of the week in Washington, so people are getting a bit tired, I think. But Edvins, thank you very much for joining us from Riga. Look forward to maybe next time you come to Washington to hosting you here. And do stay in touch and let us know what other plans you have, for not just for movies, but for talks and exhibitions and so forth.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Goodbye.
So I can go back to normal microphoning. This isn't going to be picked up all over the world. Okay, okay, good. So, well, let's go back to our discussion. Let me turn to this one, actually. Let's go back to our discussion. One thing I did want to ask you, Nina, you mentioned the Medvedev Historical Commission or Truth Commission, whatever you call it, and these three subjects that they covered. Now, did they give a verdict on them? Did they give an opinion? Did they give some legally binding interpretation? And what consequences are there if one contradicts their rulings, their opinions? You know what I mean? What does this commission actually amount to other than something that gives out official state opinion?
Well, it was when the commission started, there was sort of the charge was to investigate history further and protect the Russian image, so to speak. Originally, it seemed, I mean, actually, it still seems a very dangerous thing because it would go back to the narratives and interpretations of history. I think the Katyn reinterpretation may very well came out of those investigations turn out to be different from the expectations that originally was done. But my suggestion, and I don't know, maybe other panelists would step in because all of you talked about this as well, is that the Russian feeling about itself in the May of 2009 was entirely different from Russian feeling about itself in October and November 2009, and even more different, obviously, in the May 2010. I think one of the dangers is that depending on how we feel, we interpret history. And I think that's what the power of truth comes in, is that facts should not require any interpretation. They're facts. But I don't know, maybe you can talk about this because you mentioned it in your talk.
Just a very quick note, actually. There's a big interview with Mr. Medvedev in Izvestia this morning. And he said, he says to the journalist who's interviewing him that, I remind you that a year ago I created this commission, the one you were talking about, on the falsifications of history. And one of the falsifications of history was the claim that the Germans were behind Katyn. So this is why I took the decision to publish documents. So there are no more debates about this. Because there's still, you know, many communists in the Russian parliament are still, they're indignant about this. They're still maintaining that these are the Germans, you know, who did it, even though there are documents now available and published. So this is just a quick note to what you were saying about this commission.
Yes, I think for those who read Russian, I downloaded a copy of the commission statute with a list of all the participants, of whom only two are historians, and virtually all the rest are security people. And it has a very cumbersome title, which I don't remember, but you can download it and print it. It's quite interesting. I should also add that the American Historical Association has sent a letter of protest to President Medvedev's office. And if you know about the AHA, you know it's one of the more, well, how to put it politically, one of the more correct organizations in this country, which once published an article which equated a Nebraska mining camp to the Gulag, but be that as it may. But even they have published, and I'm a member of AHA, I should add, they have issued a formal letter of protest revealing the dangers of such a commission for free inquiry and so on. So it's on the radar even among American academics.
Well, before we run out of time, Janos, I just wanted to thank you and CSIS for hosting this very important discussion. Somebody asked me, why is it that we were interested in sponsoring this discussion or helping to co-sponsor? And I'll give two reasons. One, I think it's imperative that we honor and pay respect to the victims that seem to be forgotten. And I asked Edvins a little bit about the role of the West in some of this, and perhaps we could have a panel discussion on that as well. I'd like to underline that we're talking about the victims of communism and the Soviet regime. We are not talking about the Russian regime. And I'm sort of interested on some of our Russian colleagues talking about the writing of history depending on how the Russians feel on a particular time. Do I interpret that to mean, do they feel themselves as moving towards democracy, or are they being nostalgic about the old ways of communism? But secondly, too, there's a piece written by Paul Goebel where it says non-Russian falsifying World War II to block integration of post-Soviet space, a Moscow writer says. It's Mr. Shishkin. And he says that if this falsification of World War II by non-Russian continues, that it will, quote, inevitably be formed around the borders of Russia a belt of hostile states that he says is in direct threat to the security of Russia and all peoples of the post-Soviet space. The second reason I thought that this was important to do is precisely to improve relations between the peoples of this space. And I, as a member of the U.S.-Ukraine Foundation, fully recognize that Ukraine can't move, and therefore improving relations between Ukraine and Russia is important. And when I asked Mr. Bukovsky that, when I had a chance to visit with him some months ago, I said, how do you improve relations between Ukraine and Russia? And his answer was, first, you have to begin with the truth. And he also reminded me that when Ukraine first became independent, that the people of Russia were very normal about it. There was no opposition. There was no fear. Ukraine was not viewed as a threat. And in fact, he reminded me that he spoke to the Ukrainian parliament, Rada, in September of 90, after President Bush gave his Chicken Kiev speech, where Mr. Bukovsky assured the Ukrainians that it would be all right if they decided to separate from the Soviet Union. So again, in the spirit, this discussion is also in the spirit of improving relations between the peoples of this area, and to recognize that they were all victims of a system, the communist ideology. And it's unfortunate, from my perspective, that the current government of Russia seems to be insistent on defending that past regime. So, thank you.
Thank you, Nadia. Vlad, from Moldovan perspective.
Hi. Thank you very much, Janusz. And, you know, I thank the panel that they put from different angles, they described how they see the situation. And so for us, everyone would understand better how the historical facts are viewed from different perspectives and from different backgrounds. I would like to say that although we discussed mostly the northern eastern flank, Nadia and I we have a southeastern perspective about relations between our region and the West and Russia. I would like to add one point regarding the mini cartoons that are not spoken. We touched about millions of victims in different countries, and we spoke about Katyn, which was a horrific event. But I remember 2 years ago when I was writing, co-authored the Historical Dictionary of Moldova, encyclopedia-type book, where we dealt with the naked facts. From 1940 till 1949, about 300,000 to 500,000 estimates were killed by the Soviet regime, and there are places all over the place in Moldova, but also in so many countries, where 500 people were killed, or 1,000 people were killed. So I would call these mini cartoons everywhere in these places. And so we need to recognize these facts and understand better through what people in this region came through. If you were a farmer in Moldova, today the Republic of Moldova, in 1940, you had several external shocks that you had to go through during several years. First was 1940, after the Stalin-Hitler Pact. You were occupied by the Soviets overnight, and you were imposed not only the deportations, killings, but also a different regime. You were overnight need to speak Russian. Overnight you need to change your alphabet from the Latin to Russian and to be recruited in the Soviet army. And in 1 year, in 1941, the Germans and the Romanian army came in, and they also were recruiting, and suddenly you were one member of your family were in the Soviet army, and another member of your family were in the Romanian army. In 1944, things changed. The Soviet troops liberated by the German, and you found yourself occupied by the Soviets because, by the regime that followed in 1946 and 1947 by a famine, which was very much close to what happened in Ukraine in 1933, which killed a lot of people and went as far as getting cannibalism and things of this horrible nature. In 1949, 2 years later, after the famine, you got collectivization. And the people who had 15 hectares or more were in the blacklist of being deported to Siberia. And so you had a question about what about the rest of the people? In living in the Soviet Union, you had three choices mainly. One is to oppose, which happened in 1940, 1951 mostly, by a small group of people fighting with arms or boycotted the Soviet regime. Second larger group was going along with it, leaving your land to be taken by the Soviets and won your tools and so on. And the third group that was also present is to support the regime. And when you say about blaming, I think most of the blame should go with those collaborators that supported the regime, and more importantly, were the tools of the regime by being worse than the Russians that were present. And by looking into the facts, you see that the worst crime were committed by the locals. And I think this is why we need to look at the history and come up with the terms of the historical facts that our people went through. The most important thing is to recognize these events and these facts, which is a difficult one for many of these groups and subgroups in our countries, but at the end to go along with these terms and build new relations. And I think this is important for people both in Moldova, in Ukraine, in Baltic states, and mainly in Russia, to understand the historical events and move along with building new relations in the region, because this is the interest of the people of Russia and the people of our region to build these relations and live in peace. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much, Vlad. Do we have any other questions to the panelists, please? If you could introduce yourself. Minutes, actually.
Hi, my name is Lyndon Allen. Thank you for interesting presentations. Thank you, Vlad, and Ms. McConnell for sponsoring this event. I guess my question is really, you know, when this event was announced, it was announced as a discussion of the impact of World War II and Victory Day on current geopolitics in the region, and I haven't really heard that much about current geopolitics in the region. It seems like there's a lot of fodder for such a discussion. You could talk about the Bronze Soldier incident. You could talk about the Yushchenko administration's decision to highlight certain questionable episodes from Ukraine's past. You could talk about the decision that Moldova has taken to not send, or maybe now they're sending people to participate in the parade. You could talk about the Moscow city government's recent decision to send somebody to Transnistria with 2,000 rubles for each veteran of World War II resident in that region, and how everybody kind of politicizes the events of World War II for domestic political consumption, and how ultimately the fact that people speculate and capitalize on local prejudices and preconceptions makes it very difficult for the countries to get along amongst themselves. So instead of hearing about that, I've heard the question of whether Stalin was worse than Hitler, et cetera. It's interesting, certainly, but it doesn't have much to do with contemporary geopolitics, in my opinion. So I guess my question would be to the panelists, where do we go from here? We've agreed to disagree about historical interpretations, clearly, right, to the extent that, you all represent the national elites of your various countries. You know, there's some disagreement with the Russian interpretation of World War II. We can speak and we can insist on truth, and we can insist on it's not likely to happen, frankly. And so I wonder, to the extent that we can take a realist perspective about this, where do we go from here?
Well, if you want specifics, certainly. I know the Lithuanian case. The World War II narratives have had a huge impact on geopolitics. First of all, it's connected in the Lithuanian case also with the Holocaust. And the whole controversy around it is being manipulated by certain forces, clearly, and politicians who play to the, I'm shocked to say that, to their base in certain ways. And to tell you the details of the story, last 2 years ago, the Lithuanian Procuracy issued warrants for the for Dr. Yitzhak Arad of Yad Vashem to testify in a case in which Soviet and also Jewish partisans allegedly massacred 38 villagers in a place called Kanyuka, which is on the in the Belarus border. This, of course, raised a huge outcry. It almost immediately created an enormous problem with the American Jewish community, which has some influence in Lithuania, particularly since now restitution questions are being discussed and are very sensitive. It created a problem with the American administration, but it played well, at least some politicians must have thought, with the anti-Semitic tendencies of a significant part of the population. Now, this move was so stupid and counterproductive that all kinds of conspiracy theories arose in the country, that the Russians are behind us and all that thing. It really muddied the waters. To put it on personal perspective, I've been to Tel Aviv twice last year dealing with some of these issues in conferences and meetings. In fact, I met with Dr. Arad last year. And it has created a huge geopolitical problem for the country's image. And this is just one small battle in this sort of continuing discussion. And I did mention the fact of how cooperation between Russian and Lithuanian historians had got trapped in this political debate over what constitutes an occupation and so on. So it does have an immediate impact, not to speak of the really nasty atmosphere that's created, and also the encouragement it gives certain skinhead neo-Nazi groups to go public. And this certainly complicates matters. And I think that what I've said about Lithuania in this particular case probably can be extrapolated to other regions and countries as well. Now, in terms of the last part of your question, I think what to do from here, I'm not a great optimist that there's such a thing as shared history, you know, divided memories and so on. But what can be done is try to put maybe politicians' feet to the fire to stop doing this, and leave much of this discussion to professional historians. I'm not very optimistic that can be done, but I certainly think that it's something worth trying. But you're absolutely correct. I mean, this is a thing, this is an issue that will continue to bedevil international relations on many scales. The Bronze Soldier, of course, incident, which was exploited, and you know the cyber attacks and all the rest. I mean, it has certain national security implications for these countries. So you're right to stress the fact that in terms of current events, unfortunately, as a professional historian, I'm more interested in the past than the present. But then there's that famous quote by Orwell.
Thanks. Well, Grigory Yavlinsky, who's one of the opposition leaders in Russia, likes to say that 80% of politics is a discussion of history, and especially in our part of the world, certainly true. And if you're asking about the link between what we've been talking and the modern situation, I would say the vast majority of the so-called problems and so-called tensions that the Kremlin is generating with the near abroad countries are artificially constructed. For instance, if you looked at the Russian state media in 2006, 2007, 2008, the two greatest enemies of Russia were the superpower Estonia and the superpower Georgia. And there were incitements. There was actually a harassment campaign against the Estonian ambassador, which was in direct violation of Russia's obligations under the Vienna Convention on Protection of Diplomats and so forth. And all these kind of, you know, attempts to present NATO as the big enemy, which is now officially inscribed in the Russian military and national security doctrine, which was adopted a year or two ago. Instead of maybe, you know, what people who are not so clouded in all this stuff are asking, maybe we should look seriously at China, for instance, which clearly does have some, you know, some plans for our territories in Siberia and the Far East, which are very essentially unpopulated. And if you look at the Chinese side of the border, there are tens of millions of people on that border. And maybe strategically it's not really NATO that's the enemy, maybe it's China. And unfortunately this kind of artificial pseudo-historical narrative that this regime is basing its foreign policies on is actually very detrimental to our long-term national security. And as many opposition leaders say, you know, we actually, instead of fighting, trying to fight NATO and creating all these stupid conflicts with the Baltic states and other Central European countries, Russia naturally belongs to, you know, to the European civilization, culturally, historically, you know, geographically, obviously. And maybe it's time to join together and look at the real threats that are there. Talking about real threats, for instance, you know, the position of the Kremlin on the Iranian nuclear program seems suicidal, because actually a nuclear Iran would be a much more real threat to us than to the United States, because obviously we're much closer. And you know, from the Iranian cleric's point of view, Russia is obviously part of the Western civilization, so it's part of the enemy potentially. So all this so-called foreign and defense policies we have, they're all artificial, they're all unreal, and they're all constructed on this rewritten historical narrative which we've been discussing here. So the only way you can look at these, you know, policies is through what we've been talking about, through all this stuff about, you know, NATO being the enemy, West being the enemy, and conflicts such as the Bronze Soldier and all the rest of it.
Okay. You know?
No.
Other questions?
Well, I very much see the discussion of history of being very relevant for events today, because if you see what's happening in terms of just, I think somebody mentioned that if you question Russia's version of history, then you are, at one time, you consider a terrorist. And even in this article that I cited, it talks about the separatists won. You know, took over the governments after the war in these separate countries. So this notion that they're separatists, and again, this unified post-Soviet space should exist today, and it had implications in Georgia. It could possibly have implications in Ukraine, Transnistria, and the others. So these themes are continuing to today, and if we don't understand what happened in the past and what its implications are for today, we're going to walk into the same traps again.
Thank you. My name is David Nikoradze. I represent Georgian television network Rustavito in Washington. A lot of Georgian soldiers died in the Second World War, and this small country of the Soviet Union made huge contribution. This is a fact, and this is our history. Russian authorities invited many leaders in Moscow this week, but they didn't invite a Georgian government delegation. I was wondering if you could give me any commentary on that, please. Thank you.
Since that being my favorite country, I will just comment on the fact that it is a disgrace, and it is absolutely incomprehensible, because indeed they've been fighting shoulder to shoulder. But, you know, the problem with Russian politics toward Georgia, it's incomprehensible on so many different levels, starting with the fact that we cannot fly to Tbilisi and we have to do all the tricks to get there. So it's I think Russia just hurts itself by doing this, because it's a long process. You know, you kind of give a hand to some countries, and yet you decide that some others are not possible. And I think Russia would be better off if, say, it wouldn't deal with the Georgian government if it doesn't want to, and yet open the celebration to those Georgians who would want to come. But I think we're a long way there, because it really needs to become very secure in order to do that. So I'm sorry that we're not going to celebrate that together.
And just to put it in context, you know, the leaders of Hamas are always welcome, and they come a few times a year, you know, designated terrorist organization by all the world's major powers, and a country which fought, the former part of our own country, you know, which fought together and against Nazism is not. That's just another illustration of what, you know, what this regime behaves like.
If I could just throw in my 5 cents, I think it indicates, but demonstrates that the government in Moscow does not accept the legitimacy or the longevity of the Saakashvili government. And this is just another sign that you are going to be part of history rather than making history with us.
My name is Sophie Zurabiani, Georgian Broadcasting Company, IMEDI. So the question is, you mentioned about geopolitical catastrophe, the words of Putin. Do you think that Russia is trying to rebuild or regain the sphere of influence in the countries of former Soviet Union? Thank you.
If I understand your question correctly, you're talking about Russia rebuilding its influence in the so-called near abroad. Well, yes. I mean, the question is rather simple to answer. If only you would look, for example, to the Lithuanian president's impeachment crisis of a few years ago, in which Russian fingerprints were all over the place. I mean, there's no secret there. And the tremendous influence that Russia has in the political processes of some of these neighboring states, Lithuania in particular, is both subtle and sometimes quite direct. In my view, there is overwhelming evidence of this. And now, what are the ultimate goals is another question. I don't think now that Lithuania and the Baltic countries are in NATO there's any fear of direct military aggression. But the undermining of civil society, and some people say even the encouragement of certain extremist right-wing groups within the country, and so on. These are all efforts to weaken the soft power of the newly independent countries. Well, not so much newly now, but the independent states. So, I think the process is one of purposeful destabilization in a kind of a zero-sum game. That is, you know, you don't want powerful neighbors. You want weak neighbors who can be manipulated. And I think that if you want a classic study of how that works, is you can look into the impeachment crisis of President Rolandas Paksas just a few years ago. So that would be something to study.
Thank you so much.
Yes, I mean, if in under the Soviet system you could destabilize the situation by mass deportations to Siberia and throughout the Soviet Union, you can't do that now. So what instead we see is, passing out of Russian citizenship, huge financial investments in places like Crimea. I think I understand that. The defense minister of Russia said that he received orders to make plans for the refurbishing of Sevastopol, not just the base, the city, but Crimea itself. So there are new methodologies for old strategies.
And the once again, we see the disparity between the, you know, what we in the opposition see as the Russian national interest and the ego of this regime. Look at the recent gas for Navy deal between Medvedev and Yanukovych, signed a couple of weeks ago. Effectively, what they did is just for the purpose of, you know, symbolically keeping the Navy presence there, which is, you know, a unless, you know, there's another conflict with Georgia plan, we can't conceivably see what it needs to be there for. But anyway, this gas for Navy deal means that the Russian government now, at the time of a grave crisis, rising unemployment, falling GDP, falling industrial production, very, very serious economic difficulties in our country today, and will now be paying $4 billion a year, essentially, because of the gas subsidies to Ukraine to keep this base. And I think the, you know, this has got to be the world record, because if you go to second place, I think it's the, if my figures are right, I may need to go and double check them, but I think the United States pays something like $800 million a year for the Okinawa base in Japan. And I'm not talking about Guantanamo, which is something like $4,000, right, a year on lease from Cuba. But even, you know, there's some real figures. $800 million, I believe, is the annual dues for Okinawa. This is going to be $4 billion. Just to maintain this kind of ego presence, you know, in a neighboring country, for no apparent reason, for no real national security needs, and direct damage to the Russian economy, just to keep this pretense, you know, that they have some, as President Medvedev put it, quote unquote, zone of privileged interests. That's what he referred to as the former Soviet states, and you know, if Britain has the Commonwealth, for instance, where all the former, not all, but those who want to, former imperial colonies come in. You know, it's a voluntary, mostly cultural now organization. Nobody blackmails anybody. Nobody puts, you know, their bases. If your former colonies, if you treat your former colonies with respect, you'll get some respect back too. And this is what Britain has shown, and I'm afraid what our rulers are doing is the exact opposite. The only way they're going to, what they're going to achieve is just create new enemies by doing what they're doing now.
If I could just add, it would be useful to compare the British interpretations now of their colonial history with Russian interpretation, or this government in Russia's interpretations of Tsarist and Soviet history. In other words, I remember, because I grew up in England, the benefits of British civilization, which what was taught in the 50s and 60s amongst the colonial peoples. But that changed in the 70s and 80s when a lot of these ex-colonial peoples actually came to England and pointed out that it wasn't all beneficial necessarily, that there was such a thing as racism, discrimination, you know, very bad feeling, bigotry against the non-English people. And English history has progressed as a result. If you look at English textbooks, I think they're very fair in terms of what the English delivered and what they stifled. Is that the case in the case of Russian colonization, of the Soviet colonization period? I would say no. So history, to me, history is not the past. History is ever-present. And, of course, there are going to be different narratives from different angles, different national narratives and so on. But it's when narratives conflict to such a degree as even the interpretation of what was the Soviet Union, what was Stalin, where one side clearly sees it as something evil, I suppose you could call it, and the other side tries to defend it as something benign and civilizational, as beneficial. When the divergence is so great in the narrative, that's when I think it creates problems. It creates, at the very least, it could create suspicion that if a country cannot admit to its own history, admit to guilt, as Nina has pointed out, it cannot start a process of reconciliation. And there's the suspicion that there is an aim of continuity. If we weren't bad in the past doing this, if we do it again in the future or something similar, we also won't be bad. So, you know, history is ever present. It cannot disappear. And I'm not just talking about the rituals that we're going to see in the next few days. It's what ordinary people think about their government and about their neighbors. And I don't think there will be this process of full reconciliation unless there's some closer... first of all, if the politicians get out of the business of interpreting history, that would be the best solution. But I'm sure they won't. But at least where there is some, like the Germans have done, for example, in terms of admission of what Nazi Germany did during the war. And I think they've been exemplary throughout the past few decades. And I'd love to see that same process, some courage and responsibility on the part of the Russian government vis-a-vis the past Soviet history.
Please. And if I Could I just add one quick thing,
sure.
what I mentioned in remarks to start with? The absurdity of it is that this process was begun. I mentioned the President Yeltsin's recognition of the annexation of the Baltics, forcible annexation, his apology for Katyn. This all started, and now somehow we're supposed to think that these 10 years never happened in the 90s and that this was all just made up, and now we're just going to jump back 20 years back and, you know, come and revisit all the Soviet lies that used to be put in textbooks. This is just underscores the total absurdity of it. They just treat people for idiots, I guess. That's what it would seem like.
I think that I'm glad that you had that follow-up point, because my question was going to be, if such a reconciliation from the perspective of, for example, the Baltic states was not possible in the 90s when Russia did make a number of gestures in that direction, why should we think that it might be possible in the future? I mean, from Russia's perspective, and I'm not saying that I share this point of view, Russia acknowledged many of the wrongs of the past, if not all of them, and then these neighboring states, rather than reconciling, joined the formerly hostile alliance. You know, we can all debate the merits of that policy, but that certainly wasn't a reconciliatory step. And I guess the question is, you know, to what extent is what you suggested possible, ever, if it wasn't possible then?
Well, in terms of, you know, hostile alliances, as I mentioned, many people in Russia think we should be in NATO too, so that there is no contradiction that our neighbors should be there as well. But in terms of the response, 4 years ago, just shortly before his death, former President Yeltsin was invited to Riga, to the Riga Castle, where he received the highest civilian award, the Order of the Three Stars of the Latvian Republic, as a recognition of his and the Russian democratically elected government's contribution to the liberation, the real liberation of the Baltic states in 1990 and 91. So I don't think it's true that there were no reciprocal steps. There have been.
I think you're right about this, but history doesn't stand still. And I think the Russian problem is that instead of moving forward, it actually tends to move back. I think you were talking about, you know, we moved back 20 years and all of a sudden regained the Soviet rhetoric. But, you know, I would say we moved 400 years back because, as you know, there was a great attempt in 2007, 2008 to resurrect the Byzantium Empire and all of a sudden, you know, to really seriously celebrate 1612, which was basically Russian liberation from the Poles, you know, the Poles again. So I think that is a big problem. I mean, look at Turkey and Armenia. It's still no close to be reconciled, and yet there have been really serious strides done, and eventually it will happen. So my concern is that Russian attempts to move forward are scarce, and Russian attempts to move back is whoops in a sweep 600 years, which I find, you know, in 2010 it's laughable. But hopefully eventually we'll get there.
Okay, thank you, Nina. I think we have just about run out of time, unless somebody has one last burning question, please.
Well, I don't know if it's a question, but I'd like to comment.
Okay, on that note, unless Nadia, you want to say the last word, other than goodbye, and same with Vlad. I'd like to thank our panelists for a wonderful job, and thank you all for coming and staying, and see you next year.